Hello, welcome to all of you to this webcast. My name is Chris Welsh. I'm Communications Manager at the IFRS Foundation. I'm joined here by Stephen Cooper, member of the IASB, and Alan Tashira, who's Senior Technical Director at the IASB. And they'll be taking us through the finer points of the IASB board meeting, which took place in London during the week commencing the 18th of February 2013. Before we proceed, I'd just like to remind listeners that all views expressed during this broadcast are the views of individuals concerned and do not necessarily reflect the views of the board. With that, I'll hand over to Stephen. You're going to take us through our discussions surrounding the insurance project.
Yes, thanks, Chris. There weren't many discussions on the insurance project unusually for this meeting because essentially we've finished the discussions. There was one technical issue that we had to tidy up, which was to do with transition requirements where there's been a previous business combination and how to sort of determine the residual margin for those contracts. Essentially, we decided that the date of inception for these contracts would be the date of the business combination, and we would use fair value based upon the premiums received to then determine the residual margin. But other than that, really the session was all about reviewing the model as a whole and for the board to formally give permission to the staff to draft an exposure draft. You remember that this ED is the second, obviously, for insurance, and the board has previously decided that we will try and focus the discussion within this exposure draft on some key issues that we have changed since the first ED, specifically the treatment of participating contracts, the presentation of premiums and claims in the income statement, treatment of unearned profit, this is the residual margin and the unlocking, and then OCI, the use of OCI and transition. Those five key areas are the sort of big changes from the first ED. That's what we're primarily looking for feedback on. We are going to expose the whole thing. There'll be the full standard, a full basis, explaining all the decisions that the board has made. We'll be asking for comments on drafting for other aspects of the document as well. But the staff are busy at the moment preparing this document, and it'll be published in due course.
Great, thanks very much. Alan, over to you. The conceptual framework, big topic of conversation in this month's meeting.
Yeah, and clearly I'm not going to do a good service to the project in this, because I think we spent 15 hours at the board table this month discussing conceptual framework. The team has actually been preparing separate podcasts on most of the topics and will continue to do so. So I think if you want a much more detailed analysis of the discussions, then just keep track of the website and the project itself, because we will have updates as we go. But so essentially what I want to do is give you a flavour of what we discussed this month. Just again, by way of background, we're aiming to have a discussion paper ready for publication at the end of June of this year. And as a first step to that, the staff put out and released as part of the board papers, essentially preliminary chapters and material that will form that discussion paper, so that the board could discuss all of the topics together. One of the topics that we discussed up front was the purpose of the framework. Our reason for doing that is trying to clarify whether the framework is written actually for standard setters, in other words for us, or whether it's actually written for others, such as those preparing. The ISB confirmed essentially that the primary purpose of the framework is to assist the ISB itself in developing future standards and reviewing existing standards. And really that's why we're undertaking the project. So we want to make sure that in the future we have consistent standards and can actually justify and go back to a framework to explain why we made particular decisions. The other main aspects we had a look at were, and I'll come back to some of these in a little bit more detail in a minute, but we had a look at the elements, and by elements we mean the asset liability, income expense definitions. We had a brief discussion on unit of account. We then looked at recognition and derecognition. We spent a bit more time then on the boundary between liability and equity definitions, as well as beginning our discussions on measurement and then finally reporting entities. So you'll hear from it's a fairly comprehensive list. The only thing that's missing off there is presentation and disclosure. And we're looking at March, I think, for our first major discussion on those, and that's where we'll be looking at other comprehensive income and essentially the presentation issues. So let me spend just a minute or two talking about the elements. Essentially, and I think it's worth making the point, what we're trying to do is improve our current definitions, and so we're not looking to basically take the definitions and turn them upside down completely. We're trying to see which areas cause difficulties in some of those definitions, and what it is we can do to improve it. Now, if we think about the asset and liability definitions together, one thing that we want to emphasize is that the asset is the resource and the liability is an obligation, rather than thinking about the economic benefits that flow from the resource or obligation. Because in our current definitions, I think people aren't quite clear as to whether you think about a computer, for example, is the computer itself an asset, or is it the economic benefits that it will eventually generate that you're trying to capture within the financial statements? And I think the board agreed that it is the asset itself, as the computer, is actually the resource we're looking at. One of the things we've looked at doing is removing the term expected from the definition. We think that by removing from definition the reference to expected flows, it removes some confusion about how that reference interacts with the reference to probability and the recognition criteria. So those are the small changes. In each case, we're justifying, we hope, what changes we make to try and improve those definitions. Okay, let me just reflect on two things about asset liabilities, and I think that they both have important consequences. On the asset side, essentially, I said we're talking about the resource itself is the important thing. And really, we are developing what we would consider, I guess, or classify as a rights approach to thinking about assets. And so a resource can be something like, depending on what form it is, but you can have an enforceable right, such as a trade receivable, where you've got a contract to receive some cash, for example. Or it could be other economic resources, such as know-how and customer lists. But at a simple level, like a physical object, such as property, plant, and equipment, it's the economic resource we're talking about is not the underlying object, but a right or a set of rights to obtain the benefits from that physical object. So it's, and we often talk about having the right to use, the right to sell, the right to pledge, and so on. So, and as well as even the legal titles to items. And so an asset is those rights, and that's what we're trying to capture here. On the liability side, we had a look at three approaches, because I think liabilities probably causes more difficulty than the asset side historically. The three approaches are, the first one is to apply a principle that obligations just have to be unconditional. Now, in simple language, that means as long as an entity can avoid a transfer of resources, then they don't have a liability. Okay, so if you can choose, for example, to walk away from something, then you clearly don't have an obligation. The second approach the ISB had a look at was to modify the principle slightly. And I guess there are situations where I guess there are some conditions associated with the obligation. And I guess the sort of thing we've been having a look at is people think about the bank levies that are imposed by governments, for example. And it's not just bank levies, but certainly there are a wide range of levies that governments have in place that essentially they will have a trigger point, in that they're imposed at a given point in time, often based on the transactions that have taken place over the last year or so. And the question is whether or not that levy is an obligation that either accrues over time or only becomes a liability at the date the levy is actually struck. And in some cases, it seems that even though theoretically it's possible that an entity could avoid that levy by ceasing to operate as a bank or ceasing its primary functions, that possibility is just not realistic. The question we have, I guess, for the board is whether that's part of the principle and should be built into the definition, or whether there are going to be some cases where perhaps there could be a legitimate exception. The difficulty in developing a framework, of course, is if the exception becomes the norm, you want it to be part of the principle, and it's getting that right. The third approach is to focus on past events instead of future events. And that means that a present obligation will arise as a result of past events. The entity has an obligation to transfer economic resources to another party on more onerous terms than would have been required in the absence of those past events. I guess approach three is probably, using my language, a more liberal definition of a liability, in that you open up a wider set of liabilities. The board hasn't reached any decisions on those things. I think this is going to be one of the more difficult issues. And I guess it's an opportunity to just mention one thing. The board, where it has reached a preliminary view, will try to make that nice and clear in the document. Where the board is really thinks that maybe there are one or two approaches that are quite valid, it will actually express that and make sure it's very clear that those are the issues that it would like extra feedback on as well. So, again, I don't want to take too much away from the framework team. We also talked about recognition and derecognition, and talked about removing the term probable from the recognition criteria. I think it's often associated too much with statistical inferences, and it also, because it's in part of the recognition criteria, there's some confusion about the uncertainty of outcome, in other words, whether the asset or liability asset belongs to you, as opposed to the actual existence of the asset or liability. We did talk about measurement a bit as well. We had about a 3-hour discussion on it. Essentially, I guess the strongest messages here, one is we are trying to get the best measurement attribute for a given item, whether it's an asset or a liability, that really conveys the best information about that type of item. Inevitably, if you think about trying to get the best information that reflects the objective associated with that item, that's going to lead you to a natural consequence that we're going to end up with a mixed measurement model. And that's because how we actually measure an asset, for example, in the balance sheet, could actually be determined by whether we use it, we sell it, whether we're holding it or charging others for the right to use. In other words, if you have a look at historically by that over the last year or two about how we deal with some financial assets, if your expectation is that you'll realise that through sale, then we tend to look at more of a fair value measurement attribute. Whereas if you're realising it by holding to collect, then quite often we'll go back to more of a cost-based model. And I think that will apply as well for obligations. So depending on whether you're going to settle it by continuing to service an obligation, for example, or whether you're going to pass that on to a third party. But it's early days in our discussions on measurement. And, you know, the sorts of questions we're asking are whether it's the nature of the asset itself that tells you how you're likely to realise that, whether you use that in conjunction with other assets, or whether it's actually more of an intent-based model. So I guess watch the space, there'll be a lot more to come on there.
Thanks, Alan. And as you mentioned earlier, listeners should look out for subsequent podcasts on the individual parts of the conceptual framework discussions. Moving on, Stephen, revenue recognition, an update on discussions?
Yeah, we discussed three things on revenue recognition. One was disclosures, of which there's a number of different components. And then transition and effective date for the new standard. In terms of disclosures, there was a lot of comment on the exposure draft concerning the volume of disclosures, perhaps somewhat disclosure overload, not just to do with the annual financial statements, but also the requirements for interims. The board took a close look at the disclosure requirements and in fact has significantly reduced the number of disclosures in response to the comments that have been received. Let me just pick on a couple of those changes. There's a long list in updates that listeners might want to refer to going through all the different disclosure requirements. But two I just wanted to mention. One was the so-called roll forwards. This is the reconciliation of the opening and closing balances for contract assets and liabilities. And the exposure draft proposed a full reconciliation of these things detailing each of the individual changes during the period. Many people said that that was extremely onerous, would require new systems to be built because they don't typically capture all of the data that's included in that, including specifically the cash flow information. So the board's decided to modify that. There will still be disclosure of opening and closing balances for contract assets and contract liabilities, and together with the receivables. There'll also be disclosure of certain individual numerical items. So for example, the amount of recognised in the current period that was included in a previous contract liability balance, but there's not going to be a full-blown reconciliation. Instead, we're going to have a mixture of the quantitative disclosures, including the ones which I just mentioned, and also some qualitative disclosures to help people understand the reasons why those contract assets and contract liabilities have changed. The other one I wanted to highlight is interim disclosures. In the exposure draft, we proposed that all of the numeric disclosures that we had for annual financial statements would also apply to interim. So this specifically was the disaggregation, the roll forwards, which I just previously mentioned, and also disclosure about future satisfaction of performance obligations, the revenue that will be recognised for performance obligations that have yet to be satisfied in a particular contract. And the main people felt that it was inappropriate for us to specify in such detail the disclosures for interims when the general principle of IAS 34 is one of an update to the annual financial statements and it's much more principles-based disclosure. Whilst IAS 34 does have some specific interim requirements, these generally are fairly limited and it's more of a, as I said, principles-based approach. Anyway, the board decided to still require one numeric disclosure on an interim basis, which is the disaggregation. Many users had told us that that was a particularly important disclosure and the one that is specifically lacking on an interim basis. Not always in practice, of course, because many companies provide it, but something that was lacking in the standard and did produce problems in practice in many situations. But the other numeric disclosures we decided to drop and to rely on the general principles of IAS 34. This actually is an area of disagreement with the FASB, though. This is a joint project. The FASB decided to continue with their proposals to require the numeric disclosures on an interim basis. So that's a point of difference now between the two boards. Two other areas, transition and an effective date. On transition, the exposure draft proposed retrospective application, and we had some optional practical expedients to try and simplify that. To be honest, they didn't change the retrospective principle too much, but they tried to give some relief. Anyway, the board was persuaded that more relief was necessary to try and make this operational. Obviously, retrospective application can be particularly onerous, trying to gather data of what for these contracts going back potentially many years. So we have a new option that a company may apply at the date of initial application, which would involve not restating comparatives, so applying the standard from the effective date but to that current year, not restating comparatives. And also not restating contracts that have come to an end as determined under previous accounting. Even though under the new accounting there may still be performance obligations outstanding, if under the previous accounting it's deemed to have come to an end and all revenue has been recognised, then you won't have to reopen that. If you do go for this option of applying it to the year of initial application going forwards and not restating comparatives, we're going to ask for the old accounting to be continued in that first year, and then the disclosure would be made of what that old accounting would have shown. So that would hopefully, that would serve to provide some comparability from one year to the next. It's not as good as the full retrospective application, but we felt that allowing this alternative approach would make it somewhat more operational for many companies to apply this new standard from that effective date. And then talking of effective date, the board decided that that the standard would apply to reporting periods beginning on or after 1st of January 2017. Given that the standard will be issued sometime towards the middle of this year, that allows 3.5 years for the transition, which is considerably longer than we have used for any other standard in the past, I believe. But this just reflects the complexity of the transition to a new revenue standard when, as I say, you might have contracts that that take place over many years. Also, unusually for the board decided not to permit early application. I think partly because of the long lead time into this, the board was concerned about lack of comparability between different companies adopting this at different points. And so by actually a very narrow majority, but nevertheless, there was a majority and the board voted for not permitting early application of the new revenue standard.
Okay, thank you very much. Moving on to one of our newer projects, rate regulated activities. Alan, do you care to give us an update?
Yeah, well, actually two parts to this. The first is the interim standard. And just to recap, what the board has decided to do is to develop an interim standard that will allow entities to grandfather or carry forward their existing accounting if they're in a rate regulated environment, provided that it only applies up though to first time adopters. So these are countries that have yet to transition to IFRS. Now, there are quite a few standards. We looked at a whole lot of interaction with other standards, but I just want to give a couple as by way of illustration. The basic principle is that in the interim standard, we're trying to isolate the effect of the rate regulation from everything else in there, so that what often happens in practice in countries where they have rate regulated activities is that they adjust or include in the cost of property, plant and equipment some rate regulation related costs. And they're normally items that we might not allow to be accumulated as part of a PP&E or property, plant and equipment under IFRS. So rather than allow them to continue to do that, we want to pull those numbers out of the property, plant and equipment and isolate them so that all of these different numbers are pulled out and accumulated in rate regulation debit or credit balances. So the principle is you apply IFRS to every other standard. And of course, that's easy to say as a general principle, but then the application is how does that work? And I'll give you two very simple examples. One is earnings per share. And essentially saying, well, if you're going to isolate rate-regulated activities from both the assets, liabilities, and profit, then do you do an earnings per share number based on an IFRS profit number or the rate-regulated or both? And what the board decided was that the entity should present with equal prominence an earnings per share ratio, including the movements and regulatory balances, and one excluding them, in other words, both. Similarly, if we go to income taxes, you know, the general principle is that you calculate the deferred tax differences based on tax numbers versus accounting numbers. So what does that mean here? And you take your accumulated amounts and put them to deferred tax. And of course, the problem is that means you're making deferred tax adjustments or differences related to rate regulated assets. And so your deferred tax number in net terms will be different to the way it would have been otherwise. So what they've decided is that you should still calculate deferred tax using the regulatory deferral account balances, but instead of recognising the amounts as part of the tax number, you have to take those out and put them with the regulatory line items and then with clear disclosure so people can understand and see that tax component. So we had a look at things like non-current assets held for sale and discontinued operations, impairment of assets and so on. If you have a look at ISB update, you'll see the discussions with that. But this was really a session in which we were trying to explain in a little bit more crispness, I guess, what we mean by interaction with other standards. Now, essentially that really completes the discussions for the interim standard. And so the staff are starting to prepare a document for balloting. And we should have that out in the next couple of months. Relatedly though, The only reason we have an interim one is so we can actually do this job properly, and we have a comprehensive project. And the board agreed and approved the release of a request for information to try and get more factual evidence to help us with that project. So that'll be a document that's going to have a 60-day comment period, and that will allow us to work on that and get a discussion paper out towards the end of second half of this year.
Okay, great, thanks. And finally, Stephen, agriculture. That's another of our newer projects.
Well, yes, and it's also a project that's progressed pretty speedily as well, because we've finished our deliberations on this limited amendment to IS41. It's all to do with bearer biological assets and the board's decision that these assets are more akin to property, plant and equipment than they are biological assets. And therefore, what we're proposing is to remove these assets from the scope of IS41 and include them in the scope of IS16. Bearer biological assets are things like palm oil trees and grapevines, where they're essentially not the produce themselves, but they are bearing the agricultural produce. So the board had discussion about a number of issues to do with applying IS16 and whether it should be applied without modification, with modification. Essentially, what we've decided is we will simply include bearer biological assets within the scope of IS16. We did reconfirm that IS41 and the fair value model would continue to be applied to the produce that's growing on a bearer biological asset, so the grapes and the palm oil. And that should be obviously consistent with other assets which are included still within the scope of IS41. So those were the technical decisions. That's now the completion of the deliberations the board has on this subject. The next step is for the ISB staff to present to the ISB and to the Due Process Oversight Committee a summary of the due process steps that we've undertaken, and prior to proceeding to preparing an exposure draft, which we'll issue for public comment.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. Alan, anything else we need to be covering?
We've got the IFRS Advisory Council is actually meeting today and tomorrow. That's Monday and Tuesday in London. The other thing to look out for, though, two big publications. One is an exposure draft on novation. We mentioned in the last podcast, the important thing to note about this is it has a 30-day comment period. It's a very important and urgent project, essentially, to that's trying to make sure that our standards don't cause a reclassification event that as a consequence of some changes that have been put through by the G20 and the European Commission as a result. The second one is you should see our, and that, by the way, they'll be out this week. So, and the second one is an exposure draft for financial instruments on expected credit losses. This is a very big one for us. So it's the basically what we loosely call the impairment standard, but it's an expected credit loss model, and that should be out next week. It's in the final stages of production now.
Okay, thanks very much. Listeners should be aware, you can download a comprehensive summary of the week's discussions called ISB Update from our website, www.ifrs.org. Until next time, thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you.